This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Are romance novels more than just steamy stories with handsome guys and scantily clad women on the cover? The genre made up more than a quarter of, really almost a quarter, of the U.S. fiction market in 2016, second only to general fiction. Some people may think of romance as Harlequin-published books with a man who looks like Fabio on the cover, but the genre has opened up, and it's become more diverse in the last decade, including more characters of color, more LGBTQ relationships, and more non-typical characters. Catherine Brophy Dubois teaches a course on popular romance fiction. She's also an author of historical romance novels under the name Catherine Ash, and she's a lecturing fellow in the Departments of History and Religious Studies at Duke University. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Talk about the rise of the modern romance novel. When did it become popular? Has it always been popular?
Well, the romance novel, the modern romance novel, has a long history. It's at least, some people see its origins in the 18th century, middle of the 18th century, when novelists were writing very, very popular stories about women, and women who were not necessarily elite, women who went through trials and tribulations and found love. Now, some of these stories have happy endings. In the romance world, we call that a happily ever after, an HEA. Some of them are tragic, but they moved people, and they were gigantically popular. So some folks see the origins of the modern romance novel there in the 18th century, and others see it in the early 19th century with novels by authors like Jane Austen, which is so had such a continue to be popular for a couple hundred years now. And then others see the rise of the beginning of the real modern romance novel, the big Fabio-covered novels, the ones we think of as and use the derogatory terms for in the 1970s. And in fact, in the 1970s, there was a significant change in the industry, a significant growth in this particular kind of novel, especially in the 1970s, big epic romances that spanned continents. And once again, they were often told, often not always, often told from the point of view of the heroine. They were typically stories of women who had little power, wealth, influence, social status, who came into contact in some way with a man who had an enormous amount of wealth, power, social status. And the stories were about that woman finding love and that man usually learning to love through his relationship with the woman and the trials and tribulations.
Now, that part sounds like what a romance novel may always have been, right? A woman finding a man? Or was that also a change in the way romance novels were written?
Well, there are ins and outs. So I wouldn't call the history of the romance novel is not a progression. It's so easy for us to see it as a progression from, you know, this to that. And I wouldn't call it a progression. There have been moments when novels were more about the journey of the hero, and there have been moments when the novels were more about the journey of the woman, and the hero was a character that came along and helped her journey. There have been moments when the stories were equally shared. And then there are other genres that have romantic stories in them or love stories in them, but that have been focused on other things, have been focused on the erotic content, for instance. And that has been going on for a couple hundred years. So,
in the 70s, we also see that change and the rise in popularity coinciding with the rise of the feminist movement. Is there any correlation and relationship between the two?
Well, there are arguments on various sides, or I'd say there's a spectrum of conversation about this. There are those who say, and I'll give the two sides of it, or what I've understood to be the two sides of it. There are those who have said that romance is anti-feminist. It's a not feminist. It's a reaction, perhaps, to the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s. And their critique would be that the stories engage women, principally women readers. Now, not all romance readers are women, I have to say that. But the argument is that the novels engage women readers in stories that are satisfying. The women are looking for love, affection, pleasure, stability, safety, happiness, essentially happiness, which is, of course, why we use that term, the happily ever after, and that they find it. But that they find it within structures that are still fundamentally, absolutely patriarchal, and that is so. Therefore, it's a it's a quick one. Where it's a trick, right? You know, you're finding all this, and you're and these women. One of the things that specifically changed about romance fiction in the 70s was that women, the heroines, were experiencing pleasure in sexual intimacy, and this was a big deal, right? In the 1970s, for these novels, that the female characters were able to experience it, and the stories were often told from their points of view, so the reader was able to experience it similarly. So the other side of the argument is that this empowered women. In fact, that they were able to see themselves and see a potential for happiness in the situations that they themselves
and
were
had
in.
More agency.
Yeah.
Now, who's been writing these books?
And that also, exactly, it's an industry largely written, that stories are largely written by women. They're mostly read by women, not entirely, but mostly. And many of the members of the industry are women, not all of them, but the editors and the people in sales and marketing and promotions.
Yeah. So you talked about the spectrum in terms of themes and plot. What are the rules? What makes it a romance?
It generally, right now, it's more or less agreed in the industry that what defines a romance novel are two things. The first is that the story really does revolve around the love story. So the novel, unlike, for instance, perhaps a mystery or a fantasy novel or a science fiction novel, and we're talking popular fiction, right, where the story revolves around some other thing, the murder and the murder mystery, and there could be a romance. There might be a love interest. The protagonist might have a love interest. In a romance novel, the story really does revolve around the romantic dynamic and the beginning and the satisfying ending. And that's the second defining factor. It's that it has a satisfying romantic ending. So it doesn't necessarily mean marriage, but it definitely means that I think the term we're using these days is happily ever after for now.
I see. So things have changed. Well, joining the conversation now is an author of romance novels. Damon Swade writes gay romance novels and is also a member of the National Board of Romance Writers of America. Welcome, Damon.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Good to have you. To talk about this, because inherent in all this and sort of underlying this whole conversation is the fact that romance novels get a bad rap. Critics will say it's a lowbrow form and fine if it wants to be an industry, but it isn't literature. Talk about that critique.
You know, I always tell, when I do a lot of keynoting, and when I talk to rooms full of librarians or vendors, I always say that romance is the literature of hope. And I think that one of the strangest things that's happened to us as an industry is that we've had to sort of defend the authenticity of hope, that we live in a world in which people are sort of skeptical and ironic about hopefulness, and that it's seen as being somehow less than. And so, I mean, classically, from Aristotelian perspective, a romance is a comedy. Comedy doesn't mean funny. A comedy just means it ends well, right? Like the Odyssey. Odysseus comes home, he shacks up with his wife, everybody's happy, after a bunch of monsters and cyclopses. The thing is that most of the critical world sees comedy as somehow suspect, because anything that makes people happy must inherently be crowd-pleasing dreck. And so it's weird, because the critics for about 1400 years have said to us, no, 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 the audiences are enjoying that too much. It must be terrible. And so I think that factored in with the fact that it really is a woman's genre by for with women. I think that sexism feeds into that. But I really feel like at core, there's a skepticism about anything that makes people be pleased. You know, I think people are always looking for the foul side of things.
What about that, Catherine? What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, Damon puts it wonderfully. I agree. There, it seems to be that we don't consider it art, or we don't consider it worthwhile if it's not, if the characters aren't miserable at the end. I mean
and hopefully throughout.
And if sex has got to be awful or in some way, miserable, and the relationship has to be fraught. And
well, I guess the other side of it too, Damon, and I could ask you too, Catherine, is the fact is, because it's popular, in other words, it would attract a lot of creators, which means there is a lot of dreck out there, right? I mean, and so if you're, I mean, the same as the critique of rock and roll, right? There is a lot of bad music out there that sold well, which doesn't mean that the genre itself is inherently somehow degraded.
The industry is vast.
I think one of the
Yeah, Damon?
One of the strange things about literature is the idea that literary fiction is somehow better. There's actually way more Drecky literary fiction than there is Drecky genre fiction, because genre fiction has to sell to an audience, and literary fiction just has to sell to about 1,000 critics around the world. And so you actually see this weird pass that's given to literary fiction where they can experiment and they can remove a vowel and that makes it a great novel, whereas in a romance novel, if it sucks, no one buys it.
You have, and it has changed over time, though, has it not, Damon? I think maybe, you know, if you can give us the scope, the fact that we're looking now and we're going to start talking more about the ways in which characters and themes have changed just in the past few years, but give us a sense of the scope and the way things have changed, even with popular romance over time.
I think one of the biggest shifts has come in the aftermath of electronic publishing. When Amazon embraced the Kindle and launched the Kindle worldwide, there had been e-readers before that, but the Kindle was sort of a watershed moment. But at that moment, anyone wanting to put a book into hundreds of millions of hands immediately had the technology to make that possible. And that meant that no matter what you wanted to read, if you wanted to read about people with a wheelchair fetish, or you wanted to read about asexual mermaids, somewhere in the world there was an author willing to give you that fantasy and that HEA, that happily ever after. And so I think that the big shift has been the fragmentation of the sort of hegemony at the center of pop culture romance, whereas it's not always a mesomorphic underwear model with a trust fund who has orgasms, where they have orgasms every time they brush their hair. And now we can have people that are brown or that are LGBT or that do have some kind of disability, and they're normal people. But because of the fragmentation of the market, a book that can only sell, let's say, 40,000 copies can still be very successful, whereas in the past, a book had to cross a certain threshold to make it past the sort of big six. Mm. Those are the big publishers in New York. They're gatekeepers, right? And so I think there was a leveling, a democratizing influence because of technology.
Catherine, yeah.
Can you still hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. One thing about the industry and the genre romance, modern genre romance, is that it is equally a story of authors writing stories and readers finding stories that are about love and hope and joy and through conflict and difficulties, as it is a story of very wise, very clever marketing and production of a consumer product. So this is what Damon's saying about the ebook revolution. We really do call it a revolution because it really has changed how authors can reach their readers in many ways. Not entirely, because it's still about, I mean, there's still, Amazon, for instance, controls an enormous amount of the publishing world and of the success of publishers, certain publishers and certain authors. But yeah, it is allowed.
Well, and so tell me how it's changed, Damon. I mean, you talk about the characters that you say that the genre really has opened up. We're seeing different characters now in more normal situations, not presented as exotic.
When I was first writing romance, I wrote a book about gay firefighters, and I was told there is no way this can make money in the global market. And literally what I said was, forget that, I am going to get this book to as many people as I can. And I had come from show business. And so I decided it was not going to sit at the kids' table. It was not going to be sort of in the corner with a towel draped over it. And I decided to sell it to publishers and then to readers as a love story, right? And what's funny is, this is totally a fluke and totally fortune on my side. I happened to have published at exactly the moment when mass market publishing was open to that idea. And it changed it changed everything for me, obviously, that one book. But I think that openness transformed romance, because suddenly there was a time when if you were an author of color, you were told that you would sell fewer books if you wrote people of your ethnicity. Or if you did write books with people of your ethnicity, you couldn't have them on the cover, because that was seen as a sales depressant in places like Target and Walmart, where people like to be reassured all the time, right? And so there's this large scale shift. We see this not just in romance, but actually because romance is the Ur novel, right? It leaks out across young adult fiction, across mystery fiction, across sci-fi, because romance writers write a lot, and we have so many readers, the impact on mass market pop culture is enormous. You know, there's this funny thing where Nietzsche and Schopenhauer were always cribbing from pornographers, but because it was pornography, no one ever clocked them for it. Like, you see bits of it in their writing. And I think sometimes that Hollywood does the same thing, where they're reading romance novels, but they're not filming them. And so what you get is these strands that sort of get teased out of romance novels and then appear in pop culture. And Romancelandia clocks it all the time, because they'll say, oh, look, that trope that's been in existence in paranormal romance for four years is now on a television show, right? But it's sort of the bubbling, fertile mud underground, and pop culture dips in when it's useful.
Well, look, it goes back to Dante's Inferno. Wasn't that Paolo and Francesca's problem? They were reading a novel, a dirty novel, on the edge of their bed, and they said, well, I don't know, you know, we were just reading this book, you know, and apparently, Dante's audience would have known that book. They would. He just names the book in the poem, and you're all supposed to know it. So they all knew the book, and they all said, my God, they were sitting on the edge of the bed reading that. Well, of course they did the thing. So that's how far back it goes. And apparently it was popular, because everybody, he just throws it in his poem. It's the one thing, you know, it's the one thing I recognize in that poem. So, so talk about the push-pull of that, Catherine, the push-pull of the market. On the one hand, there are these things that have been in the zeitgeist for a long time. On the other hand, changing ideas about gender, changing ideas, as Damon suggests, give us a new openness. Talk about what your students consume and how they view these changes.
You know, I'm always given so much hope by my students when they read. But I assign them all sorts of pieces written by scholars. There is a vibrant community of scholars working on romance fiction, and by authors. And when they will read something written by an author in defense of the genre in the 1980s or the 1990s, and they simply won't agree with it. They simply won't think that they say, well, that's not how I see, you know, that's that there will be a statement about what a heroine is and what a hero is. And, you know, what defines the romance novel and what we love most about it, what we women readers love most about it. And my students who are men and women will say, that doesn't make sense to us, because we don't see the gender binary in that way, or we don't understand. We think women have more to offer than nurturing and a lesson in love. We think they also have, you know, all sorts of things to offer, and that a man doesn't necessarily need to be taught how to love by a woman. So I'm always really excited to hear what they have to say about. And I teach them novels starting in the 18th century up to the present day, including Damon's and others, and their responses to them are refreshing and exciting to me, because they do see the world, at least love stories, and the abilities of individuals to understand and find themselves and find a romantic attachment in a different way, I think.
Damon, that suggests this interesting relationship, this push-pull relationship between popular culture in general and the romance. In other words, an opening to new ideas also propels the genre and allows for a broader, you know, what do you think is dominant here, or are they just sort of driving together?
I'll tell you, Carol Burnett, who I was very lucky to know for a stretch of time when I was working in theater, used to say, the audience is never wrong. No matter what they say, they may not know why they're right, but they are never wrong. And the thing about romance is, it's an entire genre predicated on the idea that relationships are more powerful than isolation. And the difference between a romance event compared to a comic book event or a sci-fi event or a military history event is that everybody wants to connect. Everybody wants to talk. When I first came into romance, I had been in the film industry, which is not about relationships in the same way, right? But in romance, everyone wanted to help you. Everyone wants to move you forward, and that includes authors, publishers, and the fans. And the fans will come and they'll say, I see too much of this, or I wish that someone would deal with this, or they'll push back in letters and on Twitter, and you hear from them all the time kind of where the ship needs to turn. And because it's a big ship, and because it involves thousands and thousands of people, millions of readers, but thousands and thousands of writers, the turn is sometimes slow. But I really think that it all comes down to the zeitgeist of the readers and the hope of the readers. Because what you're doing is kind of planting hope.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about romance fiction and why many people argue the genre deserves more respect. Sonali Dave writes romantic women's fiction with a Bollywood twist. Her novels revolve around issues in India and Indian-American culture, and she is, I think her work is an example of how the genre has evolved. Her latest book is Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors. It's a retelling of Jane Austen's classic Pride and Prejudice with the gender roles reversed. Sonali, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Catherine Brophy Dubois and Damon Swade. Catherine writes historical fiction under the name Catherine Ash, a lecturing fellow in the Departments of History and Religious Studies at Duke. Damon Swade is an author of Gay Romance and a member of the National Board of Romance Writers. So, Sonali, talk about this. I mean, I said Bollywood style. Is that fair? And if so, what does that mean? What kind of a twist do you think you bring to your writing?
Okay, so I think of Bollywood as a stylistic thing. So it's a two-pronged thing. One is that it's actually a stylistic thing because for anyone who's watched Bollywood films, it's almost a form of storytelling that is that's very focused on emotions, like romance novels. And B, that is not subtle, to put it mildly. So it does not shy away from drama, and then the other part of it is it's the popular face of the Indian culture. So it comes with families who don't understand the concept of space and privacy. It comes from these very intense connections with your community. So it's basically a vehicle to take what's important and precious to this culture out, basically broadcast it. So those are the two things. It's the popular face of Indian culture and a stylistic form of very emotional, dramatic storytelling.
And then, how do you integrate that with your writing, which is subtle? It's more subtle, let us say, than Bollywood.
Now, I will backtrack and say not all Bollywood is unsubtle, and you know, there is some really, really good, gritty and entertaining cinema. And I think of my books, and I when I first tell people what my books are like, I say it's like a Bollywood film in a book, but a good Bollywood film. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is subtlety because it's literature, one can hope, but it does not shy away from drama, and it is focused very much on emotions, and I feel like it is very uniquely coming from a place of the Indian culture and the Indian family unit, and how Indians relate to community is a little bit unique, and so there's a lot of that in it. And of course, there's all of the changing of the society, and basically the going away of taboos, and this tightrope walk that I feel Indian women, I feel all women across the world do it, walk between personal freedom and societal expectations. Mm. So I feel like my books are a lot,
especially
about that.
On this threshold, in this liminal state where those norms are called into question. So talk about Pride and Prejudice and Other Flavors, and why you chose to take that approach.
So, for one, I'm a huge Austen fan. completely unique in that. But I've always kind of wanted to play with her stories because, to me, her stories aren't like the romance genre itself. To me, is not about finding a spouse. Although that's what it appears to be about. It is about finding yourself and taking yourself to a place where you are happy enough in yourself to allow joy and love into your life. So when you think of that in terms of Austen, there are these women and men who want to do things that are not the norm of that time, right? They want to be with people who are not necessarily whom society deems fit for them. And they don't want to only say things that are allowed for them to say. You know, I mean, I'm filtering it down to the simplest.
Sure.
But so her books to me were about navigating society and personal goals and personal freedom. And my books, even before I wrote Pride and Prejudice, I think are mainly about that. It's navigating that space, that tightrope walk, as I said. And so I've always wanted to play with her stuff. And the other thing that's really amazing and where this really came from is, as authors, we get asked a lot, which is the literary character you relate to most? And it's really funny how so often it would be an Austen character, which is really ironic because she wrote in a time when her country had, you know, basically enslaved mine. Yeah. And they were proliferating this idea that the East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet, right? And so it's and yet here are these heroines that I can relate to that well, that transcend time and culture.
Well, and is that because the upheaval that you sense, the upheaval that was the tension in that book, that is against the norms of the time, is what makes the book interesting? If they were hewing to the rules, it would not have been a good book.
Absolutely, and that's what I think stands the test of time. It isn't Darcy's swooniness, and it isn't the fact that yes, all of those scenes and that dialogue and all of that is pure gold. But the reason that it transcends is that there are things that have not changed about our society. Every one of us still carries prejudices, right? Carries pride in where we're born. We're taught from the day of our birth, right, to be proud in, and not just proud, but to almost look down on what is not us, right? And a lot of us, as we get to adulthood, have fought that off, right? And then are trying to break that conditioning. But prejudices are basically, you know, rolled into us, right, like dough from the day we're born. And I think that's what transcends. That particular story endures because of that.
Can I ask you to read a bit from your book, Pride and Prejudice and Other Flavors?
Sure. Okay. So this particular excerpt happens right after the famous proposal scene.
Remember, you've changed the genders, right?
Yes. So Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors is a gender flipped, and it's more than a retelling. It's almost a reimagining. Mm-hmm. So it stands very much on its own, but there is that whole concept of ridiculous amounts of privilege and entitlement on one side, and seeming lack of power on the other. And I flipped it where my heroine is, is the Darcy character, and the hero is the Lizzie Bennet. And this particular piece that I'm going to read is happens just after the famous proposal scene, where she's propositioned him, and he basically tells her he'd rather die than be with someone as arrogant as her. So here goes. "You wanted honesty. I'm sorry if I hurt you," DJ said. Trisha cleared her throat. "I'm surprised you think someone as self-absorbed and arrogant as me is even capable of being hurt." With trembling hands, she picked up the paper bag of muffins. "I'm the one who's sorry. Sorry that I asked for your honesty. What you just said to me wasn't just hurtful, it was judgmental. Honesty, I now realize, only has value when it goes with fairness." He had to laugh at that. "And honesty is only fair when it reinforces your own high opinion of yourself? Which you've made crystal clear you do not share." She turned to leave, then turned back. "I would never have imagined you as someone who came with such a truckload of preconceived notions and prejudices." "Are you bloody joking? You did not just pull the reverse prejudices real thing on me." "I'm not trying to pull anything on you. From what I just heard, my greatest fault is that I dare to take pride in my work, in knowing I'm excellent at it." The paper crumbled tighter in her hands. "How is that snobbery?" "Of course being excellent at your work and knowing it isn't snobbery, but believing that you are somehow unique in excelling at your work while looking down on what others do? That's the snobbish part, especially given the life you were born into." She paled at that. "I'm not going to apologize for the life I was born into, which, by the way, I have never taken for granted or misused for one moment. Tell me, DJ, if I were a man, would you see my confidence in my work and my pride in where I come from as arrogance?"
Sonali Dave, reading from her forthcoming book, Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors. I'm talking with her and two other guests about the romance genre. Damon Swade is with us, the author of Gay Romance, member of the National Board of Romance Writers of America. Catherine Brophy Dubois writes historical romance under the name Catherine Ash and teaches at Duke. So as you write this, I mean, Damon was talking about earlier the idea that the audience, in a sense, pushes this and creates, you know, sort of an environment where this happens. To what extent do you have the audience in mind and changes in appetite for this kind of work as you set your pen to paper?
Okay, so first, I haven't been doing this for too long. I mean, I've been writing for very long, but I've been published only since 2014. And if I had focused too much on what the market wants and will accept, I would never have written at all. Because when I first started out, there wasn't a whole lot of fiction like mine in the marketplace. So that's kind of where I started. So I had all of these stories already in my head, and I was going to write them no matter what. So, but now that they've been out, now that I have a readership, and now that readers will come and tell me why they love the books and what they brought to them, and what, you know, what seeing themselves in a book was like, or what seeing something that's so different from themselves was like. So now I think somewhere along the way it might be seeping into my conscience a little. So Damon is really is right, because just as he was speaking, I was thinking that my current work in progress, the next book in this same series, is a retelling of Persuasion, because I'm trying to do all four of my favorite Austen novels set within this politically ambitious Indian-American family. So many years ago, I had a reader say to me, she was gay, and she said to me, "Well, would you ever consider writing a woman who's in love with another woman?" And I said, "I would. I would never not consider it, but, is there a story? Like, I have these stories already in my head." So now that I'm writing this one, I'm setting up Sense and Sensibility. It's all kind of in my head. But it's the Marianne character in Sense and Sensibility, the younger sister, is just, she's gay, and she's always been, and I never set out to do that. But just as Damon was talking, and I thought, did my reader Ramika put that in my head?
Right. Well, Damon, let me ask you about that. You write male romance novels. What role does gay romance play, do you think, in the larger romance genre, and is it opening up?
I'll tell you, I think that gay romance is actually less about LGBT people than it's about wrestling with desire in a framework that doesn't involve the patriarchy. And by that, I mean most gay romance is written by straight women. And actually, the best gay romance is generally written by straight women. I think it's because it gives them a chance to set up a relationship where you don't know who pays the bills, and you don't know who's on top, and you don't know who holds the door. And so everything is sort of up for grabs. And as an author, that's very empowering, because you're not hemmed in by any expectations. And so I think that gay romance has had an enormous impact on the ways that you portray desire and arousal in a happy narrative, in a romantic narrative. And so I sort of see it twofold. On the one hand, I see a huge impact from gay romance within mainstream heterosexual romance. But then by the same token, I think there's a flipped effect on LGBT romance, where as it has reached this mass audience, because it has. When I first started, it was very much a niche proposition, and now it's sort of blown open. I couldn't even count the number of mass market authors that have begun writing LGBT-specific romances, because it's fun, because it's something that's actually fresh and interesting, and the drama is kind of baked in. So I think it's a sword that cuts both ways, and both of them lead somewhere good. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Catherine, you write historical fiction, and you often include non-typical characters. Tell us about The Prince, for instance.
In The Prince, the heroine is a young woman who wants to be a doctor in the 1820s, and she's in Scotland, and women weren't allowed. She wants to be a surgeon. Women weren't allowed in the profession, and so she, in a time-honored historical fiction and romance fiction trope, she dresses as a man. Mm-hmm. And the hero assists her in this. He's a reclusive portrait artist. He is a exiled prince. And again, princes are also a popular. He's an exiled prince from a make-believe country, but Turkish and Iranian. And he is assisting her by allowing her to live in his home.
So are we seeing, again, an opening? We talked a little bit about gay characters that are moving in. Non-binary, are we actually opening up, do you think? And again, I'll ask you about your students, Catherine. Opening their minds to the idea that love, desire, relationship, and, you know, it can be something that we can consider apart from these assigned gender roles that we've come to know and not always love?
Absolutely. I mean, in this novel and in other novels and in so many of the novels I love, the playing with the notions of gender and questioning the expectations of gender. My students just read Georgette Heyer's brilliant novel, The Masqueraders, and she wrote that in the 1920s. I think it was published in the 1920s. And it's about a brother and sister pair who cross-dress in order to accomplish a certain intrigue that their father wants them to accomplish. And she was playing with that then, too. So, and my students adored it. They loved it. They crazy loved it. And they didn't expect it, you know. So, yeah, I think so, definitely.
Catherine Brophy Dubois is an author of historical romance under the name Catherine Ash, also a lecturing fellow in the Departments of History and Religious Studies at Duke. Sonali Dave is the author of romantic women's fiction. Her latest book is Pride and Prejudice and Other Flavors. It'll be out in May. Damon Swade, gay romance author, also a member of the National Board of the Romance Writers of America. Thank all of you for being on the program. Wonderful discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can see links to their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Catherine and Sonali are participating in an upcoming conversation about how real-world events shape their writing. And that'll be at Duke University in Durham tomorrow at noon. Again, information about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Next, movies on the radio, mob and gangster movies, your favorites. Send us an email at sot@wnc.org or tweet us at #SOTMovie. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson is engineering the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.